This is Digital Story Podcast number 1020, October 7th, 2025. Today's theme is 5 Tips to Improve Your Photo Headshots. I'm Derek Story. Last week I talked about AI-generated headshots, but what about those of us who still prefer photography? Well, this podcast is for you. Today, I'll share my 5 favorite tips for compelling photo headshots. All of that and more on today's TDS Photography Podcast. I hope you enjoy the show. Photo headshots have been a staple of my photography work ever since I first got a job taking pictures, right? Because it seems like every walk of life, every walk of business, at some point requires a nice, clean, attractive photo headshot. And I really got to practice a lot when I was working for the Sonoma County Medical Association, because they had a big directory of doctors that they published every year. It was a big deal. It was a printed directory, spiral bound, every doctor that was a member of the association. And we worked on them to keep their headshots updated, because that way, when people selected a doctor out of the directory and they looked at his or her picture, then, you know, when you show up, you want that person to look more or less like what you looked at in the directory. So if the picture is 20 years old from med school, right, and you show up and you got a 45-year-old, then you go, wait a minute. So we really did work with them to keep their headshots updated, and they were very cooperative, I have to say. And I would set up these big photo shoot days, once every few weeks, and try to knock out as many as we could. And it was terrific practice for me, because a lot of times, many physicians are a bit on the shy side, actually, especially the surgeons and anesthesiologists and so forth. And so, you know, I got to practice my people skills with them, and of course, practice my, lighting and a quick setup and breakdown and all that kind of stuff. So it was really enjoyable. I liked it a lot. And I've continued doing headshots ever since, you know, just as necessary. And as I talked about last week, I just had a set of headshots that I did for a local bank, and they wanted to update their people page on their website. I got into the whole AI headshot last week, which wasn't really a rabbit hole. It was more fascinating to me more than anything, because I just didn't expect to run into it in that situation there at the shoot, having someone decide to go the AI way instead of the photo way. Everyone else went the photo way, and they turned out really good. So I thought, you know what? Since I was talking about them, let's talk about how to do the photo headshots, because that's probably what most people who are listening to this podcast are interested in. And I have some really good tips for you. I have fine-tuned these tips over years, so let's get into it, all 5 of them. The first one is use an 85mm equivalent lens. Now, you can play with that a bit if you want, but I'm telling you, the thing about headshots is you never really know how big of a space you're going to have to work in, right? A lot of times, it's an empty office somewhere, or it could be, you know, your own living space, or wherever it could be. There just isn't a lot of room once you set up the backdrop and the lights and all that kind of stuff. So you don't want a super long telephoto lens, because you won't have enough room to use it, right? So that 200mm that you just love probably won't work for headshots. At the same time, anything that's less than 85mm, you know, 70mm, 50mm, 35mm, just doesn't have the same positive, flattering effect on the subject. You know, the thing about 85mm and 100mm is that they have a very natural look, but at the same time, they kind of flatten the features just a little bit. They have a little bit of depth of field fall off. you know, all that kind of stuff. And I really think that for headshot photography, 85 millimeters is the way to go, maybe 100 millimeters, but I would stay within that range. This is just a little side note. This isn't one of my tips per se, but since we're talking about lenses, the other thing is don't open it up all the way, right? Like the lens I use is a 85 millimeter f1.8 Viltrox for the Nikon ZF full frame. I love that lens and it is great for headshots. It just works so well. But I'm not shooting at f1.8. I'm actually shooting at f5.6. Now, why 5.6 and not 1.8? Because you want everything in focus on the face. That's part of the thing about a headshot. You want to see the person. So you don't want anything artistic where the eye closest to the camera is in focus. Ooh, I nailed the focus on that close eye. But then by the time you get to their ear, it's falling off. That's not a good thing for a professional headshot. That is a whole different kind of portrait, right? So what you want is the whole face to be in focus and the ears and the hair, right? So you want to see the person. That's the point of it. And with an 85 millimeter lens, that works out to be about f5.6 at the normal distances you would be shooting headshots. Some people like to play it super safe and stop down to f8. I've tested that. I have discovered that I don't need to do that. So I'd rather have the extra stop of light and shoot at f5.6. So 85 millimeter lens, f5.6. And then have a camera that is okay to shoot at ISO 800, ISO 1200, whatever, depending on what your lighting is. I use continuous light lighting. I use LEDs, but make it okay to be able to go up beyond, you know, ISO 200. Speaking of lighting, I go with one softbox and I line it up so that, let's start with the center of the person, okay? I move it just a few ticks. Usually, as I'm facing the person, I move it to the left. Generally speaking, for most people, that lighting works well. So it's just a little off center to the left. Make sure I have a clear view with the camera. And then I raise it up slightly as well. So I raise it up right above their head, generally speaking, right above their head. So a little off center and then up. Now for the fill light, I don't use a light. I use a reflector. And the nice thing about a reflector is that it just gives you these beautiful graduated tones. Now both the softbox and the reflector need to be pretty close to the subject. I'm talking about just a couple feet, right? Just so that you're out of range, so that you're not getting those elements in the picture. I like them just outside of the composition as I look through the viewfinder. And remember, the rule about lighting is the bigger the light source, the closer to the subject, the softer the light. So a light box, nice and close and soft and beautiful, and then a reflector on the fill side. And make sure the reflector is actually catching the light from the softbox and bouncing it back onto the subject. Now, I just hang a circular reflector off a light stand on the fill side, and it works great. And I just lower the lights up and down all the time and whatever's needed. And that lowering and raising the lights is important because, tip number three, have the subject stand, not sit. I know sitting makes it easier on the photographer because you don't have to move the lights around to accommodate the different heights, but the headshots aren't as good when they're sitting. When people sit, they tend to slouch a little bit. Even if you ask them to sit up straight, they'll start out straight, but then they start to curve back on you. And the energy is just all wrong. If you have them stand and you say, nice shoulders, nice posture, stand, they will do that. And they can hold that much better than when they're sitting. The other thing about standing is it's easier just to reposition them. I'll have them start out with toes pointing towards the light box on the first series with head rotating around to the camera. We'll do a nice series there. Then I'll have toes go the other way toward the reflector, head rotating back around to the camera. I'll do another series like that. And then depending on how it's going, I may play with a few more poses. It's very easy to do to change those poses when they're standing. So keep them standing. Forget about the stool. If anyone's going to use a stool, it should be you, so that you can get sometimes on some people just a little upward angle works really well. And I have found that there's no hard and fast rule for camera angle on the people. It just depends on how their face is constructed. Sometimes I'm shooting slightly up. Sometimes I'm straight on. Sometimes I'm just slightly angled down on them. I don't have any set way that I do all the time. What looks good in the viewfinder, right? What looks good in the viewfinder? Find that. Take lots of pictures. Find the best angles for them. And then make sure they have a nice variety of shots with them standing, right? Number four, get the color balance right. The color is so important, along with exposure, of course. But exposure is pretty easy if you have a continuous light situation. You want it to look good in the camera. This has a number of benefits. The first benefit being, of course, you have less work in post-production, which is always big, especially if you're shooting a lot of headshots. You know, you want to minimize your work in post-production. The other thing is I use the JPEGs. Even though I shoot RAW plus JPEG, I talk about this all the time. For headshots, I use the JPEGs because my Nikon has a skin softening filter built into it that I can enable with different levels of skin softening. It has a really great portrait color profile that I like a lot. All those things happen to the JPEGs, not the RAW files. So I want to get everything dialed in really nice so that I can just use those JPEGs. I don't have to tweak them very much, just a little thing here and there. And then off to the races I go. The other reason you want them to look good in camera is because as soon as you get a good shot, you're going to show it to the subject. You're going to say, hey, look at this. You are doing fantastic today. I can't believe how nice this looks. This is going to be a beautiful headshot. They look at it. They see that beautiful headshot. And then suddenly they just relax. They just relax. And then you can really get going. Then you can get even more good shots. Once you get that first one that you can share with them, you'll get shots that are even better because they're going to relax, they're going to feel confident, and the whole thing is just going to flow really well. So getting the color right in camera, super important both for you in post-production and to share with the subject so that they feel really good about the photo shoot. And I actually combined tip number four and five right there because tip number five is make sure that you have a good rapport with the subject. Make sure you talk to them for a few minutes before you start taking pictures. Make sure you share shots with them, like I was just talking about, to build their confidence. Try to keep them as relaxed as possible. Very few people like having their picture taken, especially in the scrutiny of having a backdrop and lighting and, you know, probably other people standing in the room. All those factors tend to make people tighten up a little bit and not have fun. You want to make it enjoyable, and you do that by talking to them, having a nice little conversation, ongoing conversation, sharing shots with them, and just keeping them as relaxed as possible. So those five tips again: use an 85 millimeter equivalent lens. Keep the lighting simple but effective. One softbox, one fill light, one hair light. I didn't talk about hair light originally, but I really like hair lights. And I tend to just mount a little LED panel at the top of the backdrop and just have it shine down onto the hair. I just think it just adds a nice little dimension to the shot. By the way, another side note, when we're talking about backdrops, if you're shooting on a white backdrop, you're going to need to put lights on the backdrop too to brighten it up. Otherwise, it's going to go a dull gray. And I just basically use two LED panels at 45 degree angles toward the backdrop. As the subject is shorter or taller, I may have to raise those lights. In fact, I only made one mistake on the last shoot. And it irritated me because I had to fix it in post. But everyone was rolling along about the same height because they were all females. So they were all rolling along a very similar height. And then I had one woman, she was tall. She was 5'11", which was fantastic. So I raised up the softbox. I raised up the reflector. I adjusted the hair light, but I forgot to raise up the background lights that was shining on the backdrop so that it was brightest right behind her head. They stayed low. What happened was, and I didn't really notice it when I looked at the pictures on the back of the camera, but when I got in the post, was that background had gone kind of a off-white color, grayish-white color, instead of bright white. So then I had to do the whole masking thing, which isn't hard these days because we have, you know, AI to help us with the mask. So I had to do the whole masking thing to brighten up the backdrop and make sure that her hair looked really good, right? That you didn't get that cutout look. So I was a little annoyed with myself for forgetting to raise up the background lights when I had done everything else so well. When you're thinking about it, you're probably going to have, if you're doing a shoot on a white background, probably going to have five lights, right? One hair light, that can be a smaller light, two lights that go on the backdrop itself to keep it nice and bright, and then your one light that's in a softbox, and then a reflector. The lighting is super important, and you know, you really want to shape the face and, you know, have everything just look really nice. Number three, have the subject stand, not sit. Number four, get the color balance right. And then number five, make them feel comfortable. Talk to them a little bit before and during the session. Communicate with them. Just don't be the strong silent type and share pictures with them. If you do those things, you will come away with some very, very nice headshots. I have a couple interesting articles in the camera news section this week. Let's start out with this one on DP Review. OM3 photographers can now download user creative recipes. Wow, this is so nice. There's been some rumbling around about this, but now it's hit DP Review. The OM system OM3 gave users quick and easy control over its deeply customizable picture profiles with its control knob on the front of the camera. Now the company has made it easier to find and download custom recipes made by others with its newly launched OM3 Recipes Hub. By the way, I have a link to this article in the show notes, and there's a link to the hub there as well. When OM System launched the OM3 in February, it iterated on the Creative Dial feature from the Pen F, providing quick access to various color profiles for JPEG files. The camera came with several preset options, but also allowed users to customize various parameters, including sharpness, contrast, vignetting, virtual color filter, simulated grain, individual saturation control of 12 hues, and more. Customizing those parameters to create a recipe can be time-consuming, though, especially if you're trying to match a specific aesthetic. The OM3 Recipes Hub, however, lets you download recipes uploaded by others, allowing for creative looks without fiddling with individual settings. The new hub currently features six recipes, each developed by a different photographer and providing a distinct look. For example, Jared Z's recipe is a monochrome profile with soft midtones, deep shadows, and some grain. Kyler Steele's profile is described as a vintage-inspired recipe that focuses on vibrant greens and golden yellows while stripping away blues. The hub also features a section to check out images taken with OM3 recipes to find inspiration and see what others are creating. Installing still requires quite a few steps, but at least it's a lot easier than inputting specific parameters, something that you have to do with, say, Fujifilm's recipe system. To install a recipe, photographers need to download the image associated with the recipe, plug the camera into a computer via USB-C, and open the OM Workspace app. you aren't able to install recipes using the OI Share mobile app, renaming the recipes is also not entirely ideal, as it can be done on the camera itself after they've been installed. You can see the full installation instructions on the OM Recipes Hub website. All right, so there you go. There's more information in this article. There's a few more paragraphs and, of course, the links to the hub and to all the information. This looks pretty fun. And I'm looking at a screenshot, and they're showing like the examples and the photographer and then some description about that particular recipe. I think this whole thing is just very cool, and it fits perfectly with the OM3 aesthetic. Speaking of film recipes, here's an article on Digital Camera World. I have a link in the show notes. Why hasn't any camera brand licensed Kodak film stocks for digital simulations? Fujifilm dominates the film simulation space, but Ricoh, Sony, and Nikon show potential. Why not bring Kodak's legacy to modern digital cameras? In recent years, film simulation have become more than a gimmick. For many, they've become an important part of the modern photography experience. What was once a niche feature for enthusiasts is now integral to how modern photographers approach composition, color, and storytelling. At the forefront of this movement are Fujifilm cameras, whose digital simulations of classic film stocks from Velvia to Acros offer photographers a way to shoot with both speed and aesthetic depth. Fujifilm's dominance is not accidental. The company has decades of experience creating physical film stocks, and that knowledge translates directly into its digital simulations. Each simulation carries a sense of authenticity, dynamic range, and color character that is rooted in the company's heritage. For many photographers, these simulations are a shortcut to signature look, instantly recognizable whether they're shared online or printed. Content creators on social media have embraced them as a way to maintain consistency across feeds, producing imagery that looks intentional without hours of post-processing. Other brands have started to explore creative options. Sony, Nikon, OM System, and Ricoh now include style or look modes for some cameras, and they provide a degree of visual flexibility. But in my experience, none of these compares to Fujifilm's approach. They tend to feel functional rather than expressive, filters rather than curated, heritage-driven palette. Which brings me to the question that has been on my mind. Why hasn't any camera brand partnered with Kodak to license its iconic film stocks? Kodak's portfolio is arguably the most recognizable and beloved in the world, from Portra 400 to Ektar to Tri-X. These stocks carry history and a visual language that is instantly evocative. Imagine a Ricoh GR4, one of the most popular compact cameras today, offering selectable Kodak simulations. Suddenly you have the convenience of a pocketable camera paired with the visual richness of decades of film heritage. Street photography, travel work, and even casual shooting would be transformed, enabling photographers to shoot with intention and style straight out of the camera. The author continues to build the argument for Kodak film simulations and wraps up with this. Until that day arrives, I'll keep shooting with Fujifilm simulation, appreciating the history embedded in every profile. But the question lingers. Why isn't Kodak in your camera yet? It's a question the industry should be asking, and one photographers like me are eager to see answered. It is a good question because, boy, some of those film stocks, Portra 400 is a fantastic example. Also, the Gold series have some very nice looks in it. And we all have seen recipes that, you know, emulate those or try to approximate those different film stocks. But what if we had something that had the exact color science, the way Fujifilm has the exact color science for its film stocks, and then were easily downloadable and able to put into your camera, just like we were talking about with the OM3 in the previous news spot? That does sound cool. And I too wonder, why don't we have these Kodak film simulations, the official ones, for us to use as well as the Fujifilm ones. Maybe we will see them after this article makes the rounds. Who knows? And finally, I have a short note here, but this is kind of odd to me. This is on Petapixel, and I have a link in the show notes. Affinity stopped selling its photo editing software in preparation for big changes. What? Affinity has announced that it is making big changes on October 30th, and in the lead up to that date, has stopped selling its software altogether. We are not currently accepting new orders while we prepare for some big changes. This is only temporary, though. If you want to be one of the first people to find out what these changes are, you can sign up here to know first, and there is a link in the article to do that. The company writes on X, formerly Twitter. Affinity's store is completely offline and disabled, so it's not possible for any new customer to make any purchases. We are making space for what's next, Affinity explains. This short pause lets us transition cleanly without confusion between versions. Existing customers keep full access to their apps. This only affects new purchases and trials. If you do follow the link to sign up, you're greeted with, "You've chosen to see the future first." Now that you're in front of the queue for what's next, this isn't just another update. It's the beginning of something new, a shift in how creative freedom is defined. Keep an eye on our social channels. We'll be sharing glimpses of what's about to unfold. This is very dramatic for photo software, wouldn't you say? Petapixel goes on to say, it is highly unusual for a software company to stop all purchases of its products, even before or during a major update. But given that Affinity was purchased by Canva last year, given the choice to shut down its online store, some pivot from Adobe competitors' current offerings to something more akin to what Canva already offers is certainly a possibility. One of the factors that makes Affinity so appealing to its users is that it doesn't operate on a subscription model, but Canva does. So we're just going to have to wait and see, but I will say this is somewhat odd behavior. It really is. But maybe it'll be worth it. We'll find out soon enough. Let's stick over a little virtual camera club news. I want to shout out our Inner Circle members. I am, as you are listening to this podcast, hanging out with many of them right now in the Eastern Sierra. So, yes, it's true. I recorded the podcast early so that I could be free to enjoy the camaraderie with our Inner Circle members in the Eastern Sierra at our photography workshop there. And this is part of what I enjoy so much about our community. Yes, I absolutely love the online stuff. We're going to have lots of it in next year's schedule. I also very much like the in-person stuff, and I just like the idea that we actually have a community. It is so cool. I mean, I always wanted that. The podcast's intention was to build that, and you know, now we have that, and my goal is to just keep, you know, making it better and better and better and bigger and bigger and bigger. So if you want to be part of this movement, this photography friendship group, then all you have to do is go to the digital story, click on the Patreon tile, nose around a bit, sign up, and then we will get you involved right away. And a big thanks to our Inner Circle members for supporting this podcast. I also like to give a shout out to our friends at Red River Paper, longest running sponsor of the digital story. I am working on all sorts of new things. I'm taking pictures in the Eastern Sierra and testing out some new software. I'm testing out DxO Film Pack 8 and I'm getting some terrific looks with that. I'm also testing DxO's Silver Effects 8. And I'm going to come home and make some prints, because after I do all that testing and come up with images that I like on the screen, then I like to see them on paper, and then I know what I really have. And Red River Paper always has the perfect surface and stock for whatever I am creating. If you're interested in learning more about inkjet printing, then all you have to do is click on the Red River paper tile on all the pages of the digital story, nose around a bit, buy some paper, make sure you go to our landing page and get the discount code for free shipping, and start making some artwork on your own. And a big thanks to Red River Paper for supporting this podcast. All right, it's going to do it for me this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. I will report on the Eastern Sierra next week. Until then, get out there, take some pictures, stay safe. See you next Tuesday. Bye-bye now.